Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books and Biography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today I'm talking with Tobias Hoff, author of the book Galeazzo Ciano, The Fascist Pretender. Tobias, welcome to the New Books Network.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for agreeing to be on our podcast. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Okay, so yeah, I'm from Munich, Germany, and I did my undergrad here at the University of Munich in modern and contemporary history. I did my PhD here in Munich in a project on Italian anti-terrorism policy in the 1970s and 80s, which was a project that was part at the university here, as well as at the Institute of Contemporary History, which is kind of a non-university research institution. And after I completed my PhD, I started this project on Galeazzo Ciano, which was supposed to be my habilitation, which is this kind of second book you have to write in German academia. And while I was working on the project, I also went as a postdoc to Washington University in St. Louis and spent a couple of years at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And I finished the Ciano project in 2018. And I came back to Munich, and I'm now a so-called Privatdozent in modern and contemporary history here in Munich. And yeah, that's...
Why did you choose a biography of Ciano for your second book?
Well, honestly, that was a little bit by accident. So in the German system, you're supposed to do something different in contrast to your PhD. So I did my PhD on Italian history. I did it on the 1970s and 80s. So I wanted to do something on actually Germany. So I asked my colleagues, what can I do? And I was thinking about writing a biography about the German foreign minister at the time, Konstantin von Neurath. So one of my colleagues told me, oh, that's actually a very boring person. He's one of these like old aristocratic families. So why don't you do something on Ciano? Ciano's much more interesting. His diary is much more fascinating than anything that Neurath ever did. So I said, sure. So I started reading the Ciano diaries, and I got intrigued by Ciano and started to work on him. And when I started to work on Ciano and look into his life, I wanted to make sure not just to look at the 1930s and 40s when he was, let's say, most prominent in the fascist regime. I always wanted to connect him to the late 19th century, to so the history of his father, how he grew up, what kind of social environment he grew up. So that was kind of like my second goal. Doing a biography on Ciano, that I'm not just focusing on the 20th century, but also connect him to what was going on in the 19th century in Italy.
That's one of the things I thought was really fascinating about your book, is that it's so much more than a biography of Ciano. You use him to talk more generally about fascism in Italy, Italian politics during this period, and you draw out so many themes, and you point to things that I never fully appreciated about Italian history during this period, which is the degree to which so much of the conversation, at least in so much of the English language historiography, it focuses upon Mussolini, that it's all about Mussolini. Mussolini is this fascist leader. And you contrast that at the beginning of your book with how Nazism is studied in Germany, how there is more of a study of it as a system, and you talk about the people within it, whereas the focus on Mussolini has really ignored the degree to which that was the case in Italy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, that was another, I would say, kind of a surprise when I started to look into Ciano, that, everything was kind of focused on Mussolini. All the other fascist hierarchs, the generals, the leading industrialists, all of those people were not really in the focus of academic research. And that was a big, big contrast to what we have here when people talk about the Nazi period, where we have all these biographies about Heinrich Himmler, about Heydrich, about whoever you Goebbels, but that's kind of missing. Or at least that was my feeling, was missing when you look at the Italian or like general historiography on Italian fascism. And there are so many biographies on Mussolini. I would say in the last 5-6 years, we have another 5-6 Mussolini biographies, but not really about his the other ministers, the fascist the leaders of the fascist party, the generals, and all of them are, of course, fascinating figures. And I think what we learned about the historiography on Nazi Germany is how important these people were to understand the system. So, yes, you have this dictator on the top, kind of a figure to identify with. But it wouldn't work without these people, right? So to get a better understanding of how the system works, you need to understand the people who were part of the system, who helped to establish the system, to help to make this, structure, this dictatorship work. And that got me into Ciano even more, and kind of like a feeling that what I was doing was actually, you can use his person to explain not just his life, but actually more about the fascist system itself.
And the way you go about it is not your standard cradle-to-grave biography. What you do instead is you break his life down into these four analytical parts, which are roughly chronological, but I find really do a good job of focusing upon these elements. I mean, you start with family. And as I started reading the book, I was thinking I'm going to learn about his family here. But you also talk about this connection, which people not familiar with Italian history might not appreciate, which is how family was such an important part of politics. And that leads you to discussing these influential individuals in his life, starting with his father. I was wondering if you could perhaps start a bit by explaining who his father was and how he was so influential to Galeazzo's career.
Mm-hmm. So as you said, the first kind of part of my book is about called the family, and Ciano is the center of this kind of like growing Ciano dynasty, if you will. And his father, Costanzo Ciano, was let's say a typical kind of like officer in the Italian Royal Navy. He went to the academy in Livorno, like his brothers as well. And the military career kind of helped him to establish a myth around his personality as a very daring, very successful admiral in the Royal Army, in the Royal Navy. especially during the First World War. And he used his military career, his military success as a way to become more and more involved in politics in his hometown, Livorno. And when he found out that the old kind of party system did not work for him because he was a newcomer, he was not kind of an outsider in politics, he decided to join the fascist party. And with within the fascist party in Livorno, he was this one of the so-called moderate, if you want to use that term. I think it's a little bit problematic, but he was the bourgeois face of the fascist party in Livorno. And he became kind of the major figure of the fascist party in his hometown. And after Mussolini came into power in 1922, it took a couple of months before Ciano, so Costanzo Ciano, became a minister in Mussolini's cabinet. And he actually served till 1930, I don't know the exact date anymore. he was one of the longest serving ministers in Ciano's cabinet, became then the president of this new reconstructed parliament, if you still want to use this term. And so he was always kind of an important figure of the fascist regime, even though he was always, let's say, he was not really in the limelight as, not of course, Mussolini, as Farinacci, Starace, or all these other fascist leaders. Nevertheless, I would say that he was one of the typical pillars of the fascist system. So he combined this military tradition he had, his definitely loyalty to the monarchy, with this new movement, the fascist movement, was kind of a symbol of this cooperation between these different groups in Italy. Another reason why he became important for Ciano was because in his function as this minister, he was very good at networking. So he had a lot of contacts, important contacts, Italian industrialists like Pirelli, Anelli. He was very well, of course, received in the Italian Royal Army because of his successes in the First World War. He was also close to other so-called moderate fascists in the regime. So with this kind of network, he helped his son his son later could use these networks to improve and further his own career. And the third aspect, I would say, why his father was so important for him is that Ciano, in many ways, copied what his father was doing. So he also tried to construct these kind of networks his father had. He also tried to use the standing his father had for his own charisma, right? He said, okay, I can't be that bad because my father was so good. So you have to kind of support me as the son of my father. So I think these three aspects. So on the one hand, Costanzo Ciano is an important figure within the fascist regime. The second, he as the networker, which is also closely connected to, of course, corruption. We should not forget that. So he was very good in gaining wealth during that time. And the third part is his father as a role model for Galeazzo Ciano. So, yeah.
Yeah, all that taken in combination makes it seem as though Galeazzo Ciano would not have become the figure that he was were it not for his father. That Galeazzo, he had certain strengths and skills, as you demonstrate, but his his takeoff at such a young age in fascist Italy was due to everything that his father did. I mean, Galeazzo comes out of law school, and it's difficult to imagine him reaching the heights he did, where he could marry Mussolini's daughter and have the promise he did, had it not been for everything that his father had already done.
I would totally agree. Yes, I think without his father, without the networking his father was doing, he would not have at least started his career as early as he did. I mean, there are a lot of rumors who actually introduced Galeazzo Ciano to his future wife, Edda Mussolini. I don't think we will ever really find out how that happened, because there are so many different stories. But I would definitely say that when his father heard about it, he was definitely happy on promoting and trying to make this work. The question, of course, is, was it all, let's say, altruistic, just to help his son? Or was it also about trying to secure his own position within the fascist system? And I would say it was kind of both. When his father died in 1939, he was not that old, right? So he had still kind of, let's say, a career before him. So I think he also used his son to cement his own standing within the fascist party and the fascist-like government system. But he was definitely the most important figure at the beginning of Galeazzo Ciano's career, helped him to start his career, helped him to also choose, you mentioned law studies, helped him to choose what to study, what kind of career to take. These were all kind of decisions Galeazzo Ciano did not make on his own. So there was always kind of the push by his father, which was, I would say, and not to generalize too much, but it was not something untypical for Italian society in this kind of time period.
And so as part of the promotion, Costanzo sees, this connection being forged, which very few other fascist leaders have, which is that his son marries into Mussolini's family. You've already mentioned that you didn't, it's impossible to say exactly how it was that the two met, but I was wondering if you could explain a bit that relationship that Galeazzo has with Edda Mussolini, and how that benefits his career, and also how that marriage played out on a personal level.
That's one of these like topics you will find in a lot of other Ciano biographies, because it's there's a lot of rumors about love affairs and stuff like that. But let's start at the beginning. So as I mentioned before, right, you're not really able to say 100% this is how they first met. But when the kind of first encounter happened, we very quickly have the blessing by Ciano's father, as well as Mussolini himself, who also sees this kind of marriage as a way to strengthen his ties to this like more moderate faction within the fascist system, which is represented by Costanzo Ciano, right? So it was kind of, I don't want to neglect any kind of true love here between Galeazzo and Edda, but it was definitely also a political marriage to strengthen the regime. So in this sense, it was very similar to royal marriages between different kind of aristocratic/royal families. And then both after they married, Edda and Galeazzo would head off to Shanghai for nearly 3 years after a very short honeymoon at the island of Capri. And apparently in this time in Shanghai, they already drifted apart. This is at least the stories we can read. So Galeazzo was doing his thing, apparently meeting other women, while Edda Chano was doing her thing, gambling and taking opium and stuff. So when they came back to Italy in 33, the marriage was already, I don't want to say broken, but there were tension. And I would say these tension kind of were there till the end, so till the 1940s. This was kind of the private picture we can find. When we look at how this couple was perceived by the public, there was always, of course, trying to keep this image of an intact family. So you have Galeazzo, you have Edda, and you have her three kids, to kind of like use this family to promote these kind of like fascist family values, if you want to use that kind of term, because these fascist family values are also sometimes really overlapping to the typical traditional Catholic family values. And so you have always this kind of like tension between the public image of the Chano family and what is going on in the private life. And we unfortunately don't have a lot of information about this kind of private life. There are some information we can get from Chano diaries, where he is kind of proud of his kids, where he's proud of leading more or less a bourgeois, typical family life, not a fascist family life. So I would kind of say that despite all these like fascist pomp and circumstances around his family, he tried, at least in private, he tried to keep more like to the traditional family values he inherited from his father. Then there is like maybe this kind of another point to make. There is then kind of this story we often read that when Chano was later voted to bring about Mussolini's fall, and then he fled to Germany and was then arrested and flown back to Verona, and so on. This kind of like entire Chano tribe we might talk about later in a little bit. There's a story that at that point Edda Chano would really, really try to help Galeazzo Chano to kind of avoid any kind of trial and trying to work things out between her father, Mussolini, and her husband, Galeazzo Chano. So kind of a contrast to the years of tension between those two. I wouldn't make this kind of clear-cut kind of image of everything was problematic before and then suddenly Chano got arrested and everything is fine again and she's kind of like rediscovering the love for Chano. I think it's typical kind of like middle, right? So that the tensions were maybe not as bad as they were reported in the press. The love affairs apparently Chano had all the time were not as many. But nevertheless, it kind of like damaged Chano's own image in Italian society, because having affairs was something you were not allowed to do, except you were Mussolini. then there was a difference. For Mussolini, it was something to be proud of, to show her his masculinity. For Galeazzo Ciano, it was a betrayal of his wife, of his kids, of Mussolini himself, who was the father of his wife, of course.
Yeah, so, I was thinking that definitely had to play a role. It wasn't just that he was necessarily betraying his wife and cheating on his wife. He was cheating on Mussolini's daughter, and how that could very much be a slap in the face.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. The other part of it that struck me in the relationship was how after Ciano is executed, how you mentioned that Etta never forgave her father for not intervening to save him, and how I'm thinking that if things were really terrible between them, it's difficult to see how she would have reacted that way about her husband's execution.
Exactly. Yeah. But again, I think also Etta Ciano used this time after the Second World War to construct her own image about a caring mother, caring wife to Galeazzo Ciano. And she was able kind of to do this because there was nobody to criticize her about this, and because her father was dead, Galeazzo Ciano was dead, so we never really know if she really never forgave her father, yes or no. I'm pretty sure she was not happy about what happened, but she also used this to construct her own image and how she wanted to be perceived by the Italian, especially the Italian public, of course.
Now, up to this point, we've been talking to a degree around Galeazzo Ciano, and I'd like to now move on to that where you start focusing more upon his political career, because Galeazzo wasn't one of these sons of a politician who sort of is thrust into the job because it's sort of the family business. You make him out to be more of an active agent that he does indeed seek out a career. I mean, it's not impossible for me to imagine, as I'm reading your book, that he could have been just a career diplomat and sort of this role. But as you explained, he is very engaged with politics. What kind of politician was Galeazzo Ciano? What strengths did he bring to it? And to what degree was he dependent upon those connections that he had from his father and from his father-in-law?
So I want to start with kind of debunking one of these stories you read about Ciano very often, and that is that he was, let's say, only a puppet used by Mussolini, so that he did not really have any skills, that he was not a good diplomat or even then a good politician. And I want to start with that you mentioned before he did his law studies and he got a good degree. He got was one of the best of his generation, and then he went to through diplomatic training. So he was actually a trained diplomat from the Italian Foreign Office. He went to several embassies and different functions, South America, and then for a very long time to China. And when he came back, he was first placed in a position that would later become the Minister of Propaganda position. And he was starting to restructure this Secretary of State, which was it at first, and then later the ministry, to promote his, again, kind of like standing within the fascist regime by centering everything around himself. So already in this kind of like first job he has, you can see that he kind of knows what he's doing. It's not that he's just placed there and does everything Mussolini tells him to do. No, he has his own, let's put it, let's say, like agenda. He knows he can use this first kind of position he gets to climb up the career ladder, which he then would do by getting the job as Minister of Foreign Affairs in 1936, which is more or less one of the most important positions in the entire Italian government at that time. And here again, we can see that he starts to restructure the ministry according to his own vision. And the two goals he has is that he is, again, kind of the center of decision making, that nothing really can be done in the ministry without his blessing. And also trying to put himself into the limelight when it comes to visits to foreign countries, when foreign dignitaries come to Italy to see Mussolini or him. So he tries to use this ministry to improve his standing in the fascist regime, especially his standing towards the fascist party and the fascist party elites on the one hand, and of course the other ministers on the other hand, because he was the youngest minister in the regime. So he needed kind of this, a strong ministry behind him that he could use. And then of course, and you mentioned that as well, he always kind of had the backing of his father, of course, at least till his father died, till 1939, and at least at the beginning, also the backing of Mussolini, which changed over time. So as further as they grew apart in their political views, Mussolini would not really support Ciano anymore. He would, at least that's my argument, he would rather use him as a scapegoat for any kind of criticism towards the regime so that nobody criticizes Mussolini directly. So Ciano kind of fulfilled a very important function in this entire system, right? In this entire charismatic dictatorship Mussolini was having in Italy.
Yeah, it struck me that that was a safe thing for Mussolini to do because Ciano's status was so dependent upon his father-in-law by that point that he didn't have to worry about alienating a significant faction of the party. And at the same time, it was very easy to justify why he was keeping him around because, you know, yes, he's terrible, but, you know, he's family, so what are you going to do?
Yeah, the family factor definitely, I think, also kind of played a role. And then the question, who would kind of succeed Ciano, right? Can you just dismiss Ciano altogether and like put him maybe as an ambassador somewhere? Or are you going to put him on a different position, like, say, Ministry of Interior or even General Secretary of the party? I mean, there's so many rumors that shows you that Mussolini was, I think, using these rumors to also keep his kind of ministers in line, right? So that nobody really would rebel against him, because there was always the possibility that he would be dismissed. And I mean, once you have power, you want to kind of keep your power, right? That's
so we have this picture. I mean, he is an active politician, but in the West, in so much of the West, especially in you know, Anglo-American historiography, he's more thought of in terms of his diplomacy. That we think of him as, because he was, especially, you know, during this very critical period, 1939, 1940, 1941, he's in so many ways the face of the Italy, second only to Mussolini himself. What was his, what his what were his policies? To what degree did they deviate from those of his father? And what was he advocating maybe privately in terms of the direction Italy should be going versus the direction that Italy actually took with regard to the Second World War?
Mm-hmm. So in this, like when it comes to his diplomacy, for a very long time, and there was a recent biography that came out in Italy about Galeazzo Ciano that basically says everything he writes in his diary is kind of just, he just wrote that down to make himself look good, to make himself the only person in Italy who would try to keep Italy out of the war. So kind of the anti-Mussolini, right? And even though we have to be careful about what he's actually writing in his diary, when I was doing my research, I actually found kind of like similar statements by himself, by his colleagues, by the people who was talking to from London, from Washington, and so on, that kind of supports what he's writing in his diary. If we leave aside some of the more pathetic, like and emotional statements he's making in his diary, so basically, I would say where he kind of had the same idea like Mussolini was to transform Italy into a global player, right? So make Italy one of the great powers in the world. So that was kind of the where we both had the same idea. The question is how to get there. And I would say Ciano was much more trying to avoid a great war because his belief was that there was not really from like a moral attitude. It was more that Italy can't win a war. That was his idea. So that's why he wanted to increase Italy's power by diplomatic games, trying to play the allies against each other to gain territories from France and so on. So he tried to do these kind of like territorial gains by diplomatic means. And of course, also because he was the Minister of Foreign Affairs, right? If you have a war coming up or you're in a war, usually the Minister of Foreign Affairs plays a not so important role during the war. He only plays a role when we have the peace treaties and or like the negotiations again, which might be then too late, actually. So that was another reason why he tried to increase Italy's power by diplomacy and not by war. Of course, he had a different idea of diplomacy than his Western allies, which were more about like compromises trying to kind of safeguard a certain status quo. He used bribery. He used war against smaller nations, less powerful nations like Albania, to gain more influence. So kind of terror and violence were always kind of parts of his diplomacy. Also bluffing was a big something he was very proud of, right? Trying to kind of tell the British ambassador something different than he's going to tell the French ambassador so that in the end he can kind of play both against each other. So he was very like proud of this kind of diplomatic games, even though he might have definitely overestimated his abilities and underestimated the abilities of his counterparts. I would say the big difference between like Mussolini and Ciano was not so much the overall goal, if we define it as making Italy into a great power. It was how to get there. And so when you read all these diary entries of Chano in the summer of 1939, when he's saying he's actually fighting like a lion to keep Mussolini out of the war and stuff like this, I think that's actually not so far from the truth. What we should, of course, always remember that he was not alone, right? It was not just Chano who was trying to keep Italy out of the war. It was Chano plus a very heterogeneous group where we can find members of the church, members of the royal family, other ministers, and so on. So it was not just Chano, but he was, his, let's say, his foreign policy or his idea at that point was supported by a heterogeneous group of different factions. And when that kind of group fall apart because they did not really have the same kind of like goal, or they could not agree on a same goal, then also the opposition, Chano's opposition to the war kind of, yeah, waned.
And this ultimately, you know, plays into this argument, not argument, it's not the word, but this you know, question about Chano succeeding Mussolini. And this is something that I when I came to your book, I had sort of, absorbed through a variety of other sources, this idea that Chano was sort of the heir apparent. And yet you, as you describe it, that wasn't the case. I mean, that he was, there was certainly that, you know, the rumors, it was in the air. It was something that people gossiped about. But as you make clear in your book, that Mussolini never, you know, patted him on the head and said, you know, when I go, you will replace me. And in fact, you describe how Chano is in a very interesting, you use the question of the succession to examine Chano from a variety of very fascinating perspectives, I thought. You talk about him from the standpoint of what's happening with Italian fascism generationally, and how he's, in this sense, he's sort of a transitional figure. You also, though, talk about his image, especially in terms of how that image contrasts with Mussolini. And the way that you use the photographs in your book to illustrate that, I thought was especially fascinating, about how, you know, Chano, didn't quite cut the same image that Mussolini did. And it made me think about how, in some ways, that made Chano safe, that Mussolini never had to fear him because Chano was never going to command the same degree of admiration, of respect for his masculinity that he did. And in that sense, while Chano may potentially, hypothetically, have someday succeeded Mussolini, he was certainly never going to be the threat to Mussolini's position that someone who had that same masculine image was.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, this kind of the last part of this book, where I'm looking at, yeah, as you said, the kind of the question of succession in fascist Italy, and you're right. I mean, there were a lot of rumors, not only in Italy, but in the Western countries as well, in Great Britain, and in the United States, about Galeazzo as being the perfect candidate to succeed Mussolini because of his, of course, personal private ties. And so I wanted to actually try to look into this question more and see, first of all, did Chan really have this ambition? And I would say there was a short time period where he had this kind of ambition to succeed Mussolini, but not necessarily in trying to get rid of Mussolini and then be the new Duce of Italy, but more like when Mussolini decides to go, I'm here, I can take over. So there was this small, very short time period, I would say. And he tried to construct these, kind of this image of the perfect fascist leader, which you can find in him as the fascist soldier, like trying to copy Mussolini as the person who would lead the Italian army to glory. So you have all these photographs and pictures from from Chano during his when he participated in the Abyssinian campaign and the Abyssinian war. You also have Chano trying to construct this image as the new man, so a new man who is a fit athlete, right? So you have these pictures of him trying, of him swimming, of him rowing, of him skiing. There are so many pictures. If you look through these picture databases, it's sometimes really fascinating and funny. But when you compare these pictures to Mussolini's photographs, first of all, you are struck by a huge difference. So while Mussolini seemed to be always in control of what he's doing, swimming, skiing, or being the leader of standing on the top of a tank and talking to his soldiers, Chano seems always a little bit off. So he does not look as being in control of what he's doing. And so when you see these pictures, you are like more, this can't be the new man. This does not feel right compared to Mussolini, of course. And so it's maybe not surprising that if you go through the Italian journals at that time, you don't really find these pictures. You find them in German newspapers and in German journals, but not in Italian journals. So it was kind of, I guess, realized that maybe these pictures would not work or these photographs would not work. So this is where I think Chano kind of failed to construct an image of himself as the fascist new man. But also he loved to be surrounded by an aristocratic establishment. So, and of course the aristocracy in at least Mussolini's mind was a arch enemy of fascism. But Chano loved that. Chano loved to be part of this, especially Roman nobility. So you will have we have a lot of pictures of him doing typical aristocratic things like going golfing, for example. So golf was his favorite sport. So while Chano failed to construct this image of the new fascist man, he kind of succeeded in constructing an image of himself as a member of the aristocracy, which he was very proud of, because his father only got knighted a couple of years earlier. But this image then conflicted once again with the image of the fascist new man. So you're right when you say that Mussolini did not have to fear him, because the way Chano or the way Chano's image was perceived in the Italian public would never give him this kind of charismatic authority Mussolini had. Mussolini only had to kind of fear him if Chano would work closely together with other groups of the fascist regime who were also more and more critical to what Mussolini was doing.
And as you explained, that's something that, I mean, it actually does happen in terms of how Mussolini loses power. But up until that point, Chano seems to be so alienated from those groups because of his middle classness, his aspiration for luxury, which is seen as by a lot of hardcore fascists as decadent. It left me the impression that but for Mussolini's support all to that time, he would not have been as accepted by the party, and that, you know, that added to his value to Mussolini, because he was never going to build up that alternate power base to try to, you know, overthrow Mussolini. It really took the circumstances of the war, the fact that Mussolini was, you know, that the regime was in such danger, that and at that point, he even took the king aligning against him in order for Mussolini to lose power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we should also not forget it was not just like on the fascist group that would not support Chano, but also the church and the monarchy. So the other two big players in fascist Italy, which are, in my opinion, still not, or we don't really have enough studies about the role of the church and the role of the royal family during the time period. But for these two groups, Chano was also not the perfect person who could succeed Mussolini for different reasons. So the king was like, Chano is way too young to actually take over. He also has these family ties to Mussolini. So he was, he feared actually that Edda Mussolini would at one point stab her husband in the back and take over herself, be that as it may. But he, Chano would not have the support of the royal family and this group of people, and he would also not have the support of the church, even though the relationship between Chano and representative of the church were not too bad. But for the church, Chano was also not the sincere person who was necessary to take over after Mussolini, or even before Mussolini, was actually taken or arrested by the Carabinieri. So it was not just the fascist ministers and the fascist party. It was also the other two players that would not support Chano to kind of succeed Mussolini.
And that, of course, brings us to the final stage of his life, which is, you know, after Mussolini loses power, you have his detainment, you have his rescue, the Italian Social Republic, and yet Chano's, you describe his flight to Germany, which you make it clear, you know, it demonstrates, you know, Chano's limited judgment. He didn't appreciate how much the Germans despised him, and how that leads to this trial, where he's this very, I mean, he is easily the most visible figure in it. He is, and how it seems like in some ways, you make it clear, and this gets to something that you haven't really mentioned about the diaries, but you make it very clear in your book, is that you have to really be careful with the diaries, because, you know, Chano, you know, had a chance to go through them and not quite sanitize them, but definitely pare them down to alter his image a little bit. But how Chano, at the end, he comes across, to a degree, as he's more of an Italian patriot than he was ever a hardcore fascist, and how that plays, that's how he chooses to present himself at the end of his life, and how this comes across in a couple of the stories about his execution, and how he supposedly shouted "Long live Italy" rather than say "Long live Mussolini" or "Long live the Italian Republic."
Mm-hmm. And I think that is what I also kind of try to do in the book. So if you, in other biographies and also in memoirs, for example, this kind of image of Chano as the patriot at the time of his trial and then execution, you mentioned Long Live Italy, was always used to contrast what he was doing before. And what I try to do is kind of like, let's say, find traces of this patriotism Chano has early on, and not make this kind of a radical break with his earlier life as a fascist, or like as a minister of the fascist regime, I should say, but kind of try to put this into his life story, and how he became to realize that it's maybe not Mussolini or the fascist party that is important, but it's actually Italy that's important for me. There are other times in his diary where he actually always says, like, Italy comes first, then it's Mussolini, then it's fascism. So where you can kind of see that his admiration of Mussolini kind of declines over time. There's no doubt that he was an admirer of Mussolini when he started his career, but over time, this kind of like decrease this admiration for different reasons, which I think might take too long to now to mention. But it of course kind of culminated in this trial you mentioned in Verona, where he was the most prominent figure or the most well-known figure. Who was put on trial. Many others were also put on trial, but they were not arrested, or the Social Republic was not able to find them and arrest them. So he was the most prominent figure. And he tried to different strategies to get out of this trial alive by first kind of claiming that he actually wanted to rescue Mussolini, or that he helped to rescue Mussolini when Mussolini was arrested, that his vote was never against Mussolini. It was more about continuing the war and trying to involve the monarchy more, because they actually had to do something as well. It should not be just Mussolini who's rescuing Italy, but the monarchy should do something too. And then it kind of slowly shifts his argument when he sees that this is not working. And this is when he comes up with that actually he was betrayed. He's the person who's betrayed, and he did not betray Italy, but it was the fascist regime that betrayed Italy. And this is kind of the image then that was also used by his wife, by Edda Ciano later on. It was used by the Allies to put blame, especially on, particularly on Mussolini and the fascist, or the people who still supported him after 1943. So it was used by different faction, and that helped kind of in the afterlife of Ciano to establish this image as he was this young, maybe naive admirer of Mussolini, but then finally, when he was on trial, he discovered his real patriotism. And I tried to make this a little bit a more nuanced development in my book.
It's something that I found to be especially fascinating, because it in so many ways serves as a microcosm of how externally the Allies come to terms with Italy and fascism, in the sense that Italy didn't have quite the same long road of rehabilitation after the Second World War that Germany did. And the degree that the Italian Social Republic plays a role in this, where you could basically sort of treat fascism as the tumor, Italy's fighting against it. And so Ciano personifies this idea that you could say that, you know, it's not the entire country that is to blame. It is, in fact, Mussolini, and that even the people around him, in a sense, saw the light and were rejecting him at the end. And so therefore, we could go ahead and kind of bring it full circle, illustrates why that focus upon Mussolini as being, the be-all and end-all of Italian fascism is so flawed and inaccurate, but it's one where the seeds of it, you can see it being planted, in the 43-44 period.
Yes, exactly. I think, and Ciano once again kind of personifies this story about what was going on in Italy, right? It's, his diaries, his were kind of used to also promote this picture of the Italian people were actually innocent. They were betrayed by Mussolini. Then Mussolini kind of was betrayed by the Germans. This entire story of betrayal is something that runs through Italian history since the 19th century. And that, of course, kind of like... And the Italians were never really forced to come to terms with their fascist past, as were the Germans or... we have, of course, also war crime trials in Italy, but they also stopped pretty quickly. So there was this atmosphere where this kind of narrative of the good Italian and the bad German would would flourish. And Ciano could be used as an example of this good Italian. Yes, maybe naive, not up to his job, maybe. You could criticize him for a lot of things. But he was also kind of the good Italian who at the end realized what he was maybe doing was wrong at one point, and he tried everything in his power to reverse this, but he was not able to. And this narrative runs through the entire, like, first Italian Republic through the second Italian Republic. If you watch movies, or one movie, for example, or like TV movie show, whatever you want to call it, I'm kind of fascinated with is one that is called Mussolini and I from the 1980s, where Anthony Hopkins plays Galeazzo Ciano and Bob Hoskins plays Mussolini. And this entire movie has the same kind of like story, this idea that Ciano tried everything in his power to keep Italy out of the war, that the Germans betrayed Italy, and that Mussolini kind of gave in and let things happen and didn't do anything to save Italy, right? So this story is, I think, very, very important to understand how Italy looks at his fascist past, and as you mentioned, kind of like go back to where we started, where we say this is also the reason why everybody was so fascinated always to write something about Mussolini, because he was the face of fascism, right? And this is why we have so many biographies about Mussolini, and nobody really looks at the other people in his cabinet, in the fascist party, in the army, and so on. And I think this, I hope, will change so that we can get a better understanding of how this fascist regime in Italy worked, and how it is also maybe different to the National Socialist regime, or where we really find similarities. But I think before we are able to really compare these two regimes, we have to do a lot more about these ministers and important figures in the regime.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
I'm doing now something totally different, I guess. Different, and also it has, of course, some connection to my Ciano project. So my current project is about the global food aid policy during the Ethiopian famines in the 1970s and 80s. So I'm again in the 70s and 80s, but now kind of like a humanitarian a topic on the history of humanitarianism. And the connections, of course, are there when we think about the fascist war and then occupation of Ethiopia in the 1930s, 35, 36. And the fact that when we have the first famine the first famine I'm looking at in the 1970s, you still have Haile Selassie as the emperor of Ethiopia, who was the emperor when Mussolini invaded the country. So there are connections, but it's kind of a new project. I just wanted to do something else, and
It sounds like a fascinating project. Perhaps when you've completed it, it's published, we could have you back on the podcast to discuss it.
I would love to. Yeah, just have to write it first. But
I know how that goes. Well, Tobias Hoff, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you so much as well.